Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 3 of the case against Adnan Syed. Justice is arbitrary. My name is Rabia Chaudhary, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
All right, so we all watched episode 3. I watched it 3 times. And yeah, so this is the episode where it seems like we're getting some new stuff that at least I hadn't been aware of before. And the first 2 episodes felt a little more foundational. What did you guys think in general?
I think we get an idea of where this documentary is heading and where it's, what its view or its narrative of the case is going to be. Obviously, in 4 episodes, you cannot cover the entire case. You can't cover any case in that amount of time, let alone this one. But they have chosen to show the whole case through a lens looking at a certain feature, or well, many features. And I think it's coming into scope. It has to do with how to explain Jen and Christy and Jay, and how to explain how the story came to be.
During the time of this digging, we received a phone call, and I didn't even get a chance to talk to him. He told him that I was busy.
If somebody were in Lincoln Park and received 2 calls, those calls would indicate the cell site for Lincoln Park.
Correct.
Right. So they're really scrutinizing the state's narrative here, right? And also, I think, kind of trying to figure out, what is the deal with Jay? Like, who is he? And why did his stories change over time and all these things, and how he got involved in the whole thing? And so the episode opens up with his ex-girlfriend, Nikisha, who's also the mother of his son, calling Jay.
Hello? Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening. At first, he told me that he was there, that, you know, everything that he had stated was true. And he told you that, but you didn't think he was serious. So what, you ain't freak out when you actually, like, seen it and, like, was at the place and all that stuff? What did you do? Like, how did you get off and stuff? And then he broke it down to me and was like, he's basically ratted out the guy to get himself out of jail with the police.
Damn. It was a lot of crooked-ass cops back then. So what, they basically try to give you the story, or you just knew about it because you was there with the guy?
Pretty courageous of her to do that, especially given their history of domestic violence. Well, what did you guys think about the conversation, though?
Well, I know that's actually, they've made some changes to that scene, trying to figure out how to tell the story. And the problem is that Jay, like, is Jay. He tells so many stories, not just, like, from time to time, but in the same conversation. So in that one conversation, Jay is telling the same story multiple different ways. And how do you convey that accurately when you only have one side to tell you what happened?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if we believe what Jay has told Nikisha as she relays it, he got busted with a bunch of pot, and that's what led to him cooperating and pointing the finger at Adnan. And of course, that's something we were completely unaware of. If it's true, and that's a big if with Jay, that's a huge Brady violation if the state didn't disclose that this pot bust is what led to him participating. But again, it's tough because Jay has so many stories, we don't know what to believe and what not to believe.
On the other hand, if Jay really had enough pot that to make this story true, then why was he and Adnan driving around looking for a corner salesman for like 2 hours on the day of the murder?
Right. I tend not to believe that story only because of what we know, what's documented in terms of how the police first got to Jay, right? They went the cell phone evidence. I mean, they followed the cell phone evidence, the cell phone records to Jay, and then they met with him a few times, and they, you know, if they busted him with a bunch of pot, it almost would have been like kind of a happy, lucky coincidence for them because it gave him some leverage over him. That just is so coincidental. It doesn't make sense. Okay, he got busted with pot. Okay, how can I get off? Oh, I mean, is he trying to say, I thought, well, let me offer you some information on a case you're working on? Is that what he's trying to say? And to get off the pot deal. But to get out of a pot charge, he accepts like an accessory for murder charge. I mean, like, it doesn't make sense.
And you can hear in the part side of the call that you can hear, Nikisha's like trying to get details from him, which Jay never gives basically. But she's like, how did you react when you saw the body? Like, that would be an emotionally traumatic event in anyone's life.
She's trying to very casually.
And yeah, like, well, you know, like, I could tell there was like concern in her voice. She sounded genuinely concerned, as she would for anyone asking about when they saw that body. But you can tell she's confused too, because Jay is not giving the kind of responses that like you'd expect in the situation.
I thought it was interesting that she said that she, to her, it seemed like he was being eaten up. I don't know what that means. You know, one of the things that I was talking about with somebody earlier today is how every time anybody speaks to Jay, Jay reiterates that, you know, he believes that Don is guilty. And I realized that, you know, one of the things is like, it could also be a defense mechanism, because if he allows himself to think that maybe Adnan is not, that is going to be a big wave of guilt for him. He kind of has to, just to preserve his own, I guess, sanity in a way.
Yeah, and it's tough to say, because we're getting what Jay had said to Nikisha through Nikisha. It wasn't entirely clear to me whether she's saying that Jay's story was that he completely made this up, or that he sort of bolstered the story in certain ways beyond what was true. And so for me, it kind of raises more questions than answers, but it's also Jay, so kind of like the two of you, I don't really give it much credence whatsoever, one way or the other.
Yeah, my understanding is that he told it both ways.
He said both things.
So here's the problem. Nikisha lives in Maryland, and Jay lives in California, and those are both two-party consent states. No matter what Jay says, there cannot be a recording of it unless he's agreed to it. And he obviously is not going to agree to that.
But again, so, I mean, like, you know, even if it was recorded, we probably would be just as confused.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, part of me, like, of course we want to talk to Jay. Of course everyone wants to hear from Jay. But, you know, the whole, like, really, is that going to help anything? How is that going to help anything? I mean, there's a hope that it could help. But in reality, I don't think it ever will. So, I mean, I've obviously tried to talk to Jay. I'm guessing after episode 3, he's not going to be talking to anyone. So it's probably not going to ruin anything. But, I called him, and the first time we texted, I told him who I was and why I wanted to talk to him. And the first thing he said to me was, "Nothing you can say can change my mind about Adnan or the case." I'm like, okay, one, I'm not trying to change your mind about anything. And two, if you saw a body in the trunk, how am I going to change your mind about it? Like,
right.
Come on, Jay.
That's not what somebody says. That's not what somebody says when they have direct knowledge, like direct personal knowledge of an experience. That's when somebody has an opinion of something.
Yeah, and I'm like, I don't care what you think about Adnan's guilt. It doesn't matter to me. That's not why I'm trying to talk to you, Jay.
But he's never said to you, "I know he's guilty because I was there. I saw it. I saw him with the body." Like, he's never said that.
Not
right?
to me, no. And not okay. to and not to anyone that I know has spoken to him.
Not to Nikisha either.
I mean, it all comes back to what that one phrase from the Intercept interview. "Anything that makes Adnan innocent has nothing to do with me."
Oh, my God.
That says it all.
He's such an enigma.
Like, even in that interview, when he's telling a new story of how this all happened, he is basically acknowledging that, okay,
there's a possibility that Adnan's innocent.
Yeah. If it turns out this is all bullshit, then his innocence has nothing to do with me. I'm just totally independent of that.
Yeah. But his guilt does have everything to do with you, Jay, so.
Oh, yeah. One time Jay told me, he was like, "I think the stories you're chasing are lies." I'm like, well, no shit, because it's your damn stories, Jay.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah.
He can be, I think he can be like, inadvertently poetic sometimes without meaning to be. Unintentionally, maybe that's a better way, unintentionally poetic.
With Instacart, you can have all the following: groceries delivered in as little as an hour or at a time that works with your schedule, exclusive coupons, the ability to use it at your favorite stores, and other perks like no sitting in traffic, looking for parking, or waiting in the checkout line. Here's how it works. First, you choose. Get the app or go to instacart.com and shop for the groceries you need from your favorite local retailer. Then, Instacart shops. Your shopper gathers your groceries with care by selecting excellent produce and contacting if necessary. And finally, Instacart delivers. Your groceries will arrive in as little as an hour or at a time that you select. Now, I can recommend Instacart from personal experience. A couple of weeks ago, my schedule was slammed like it usually is, and I had no time to make it out to my local Whole Foods. So I just went to Instacart.com, filled my virtual cart, and my groceries were delivered within the hour with some discounts based upon coupons. And now you too can try Instacart and get $10 off your first order. To get this limited time offer, go to Instacart.com or download the mobile app and enter my promo code undisclosed at checkout. That's $10 off your first order today at Instacart.com or through the mobile app. And don't forget to enter my code undisclosed. Instacart.com or through the mobile app with my code undisclosed at checkout.
All right, so let's move on a little bit. Now, the timeline kind of goes back and forth. This is Nikisha talking to Jay, present day, but then we go back into how Asia got pulled back into the case, almost got pulled back into the case, or how I first contacted Asia. And, you know, that story is told in the episode. What's always tragic about that is, God, I wish you know, when Adnan was first arrested, I wish I actually had talked to him about the substance of the case, and I just wouldn't do it because I thought, you know, I just want to be there to support him. I don't want to like worry him. I don't want to like visit him and be like, tell me what's going on. And I also didn't want him to think I had some kind of morbid fascination with everything. I just kept it always light. And I wish I had, because maybe if I had those conversations back after he was arrested, he could have told me about Asia then instead of after he was convicted, and things would have turned out differently. But I am glad that I had a yellow pad with me and I was like, write this affidavit down right now. That saved us years later a little way. And Asia gets into this conversation with Yurik. You know, she calls Yurik and she's so meticulous, not just in her memories, but just like, you know, maybe that's why her memories are so great, because she actually documents stuff. She writes it all down.
I figured with him being a prosecutor that he would be a reliable source for information. And I gave him a call and I actually took notes on the conversation. I told him that I saw Saeed in the library in 1999. He told me that they had cell phone records and they had a witness that confessed to helping him bury Hay. And then I wrote down something Yurik said to me directly. If I had any doubt that Adnan didn't kill Hay, it would be my moral obligation to see that he didn't serve any time.
So for people who are new to the case, you know, that might have come as a shock, that this prosecutor, you know, first talked to her and kind of tampered with her, really, and then got on the stand and lied and said that she had told him something completely different, which is that we had bullied her into writing that the letters.
Yeah, and it was hard to watch that part, because that whole issue with Yurik and how he sort of misled the court. That's a big reason why this whole PCR hearing was reopened, and even we got the past 3 years even happened as far as the non-legal case is concerned. And yet now the Court of Appeals, when it reached its decision a few weeks back, it's as if that the whole issue of prosecutorial, like the misconduct from Yurik, doesn't even exist.
I feel like it was kind of like forgotten once it left Welch's courtroom.
Yeah.
Was it ever raised again, like in other briefings? I don't think so, Colin. Was it?
No, it was basically used to reopen the proceeding. But then after that, Judge Welch at the hearing kind of seemed disinterested in the reason why they got where they were. He was just focused upon getting that testimony and seeing how it impacted the case.
Well, I will say this, though. You know, I was talking to Adnan about that one time, and he goes, you know, if Yurik actually hadn't said that, because he didn't have to. He could have just, you know, he didn't actually have to add that little part of that she said she was under duress. He's like, because he said that, you know, that's how I got another shot at this. So in a way, yay for Yurik being a lying weasel.
But on the other hand, if he hadn't said those things to Asia in the first place, I mean, there's a good chance right. She would have come forward. Obviously, Asia was not shy about coming forward when she understood what was happening. So if she'd gotten the full story back then, and not saying Yurik had to tell her, like, you know, you should definitely go testify. But if he just said, like, here's the, yeah, there's a PCR hearing. That's probably why they're trying to talk to you, and not gone beyond that. Maybe we would have been like all this resolved 4 years ago.
Well, she moves from her experience with Yurik to her experience with Thiru. Thiru Vignaraja, who has been prosecuting the case for the last few years. He was the former deputy attorney general of the state. Then he moved into private practice, but he continues to represent the state. And Thiru, you know, we saw him like during the PCR hearing. He held a couple of pressers and a number of times raised Asia's, I would say, credibility. I mean, basically, it was like she offered to lie for Adnan. So he's outright calling her a liar.
I think what's clear to the judge based on the record is that Asia McClain was not a weapon for the defense. She was a potential weakness. What Asia McClain presented in 1999 were two letters that looked at best confusing and at worst doctored.
She has a lot of scrutiny and a lot of people saying horrible things about her. Just go on Reddit and look up Asia. And then that leads to Asia talking about everything she suffered online. And she did get attacked a lot. I got attacked a lot, but I was there for it. I'm like, I don't care. Like, but she didn't ask for it. And that was really, yeah, that's been really hard on her. And, you know, she had a couple of miscarriages in this whole time, you know, and she was heavily pregnant during the PCR. I mean, it was a lot for her a hell of an ordeal for somebody who's just a non-biased witness to want to come and testify to what they remember and what they continue to stand by.
And the whole idea of this being fabricated, I keep going back to the fact that she was a high school student. Like, what do they expect her to write? Like a formal affidavit from the start? Like, the idea that this was fabricated is just nonsensical on so many levels. The most important one being that if you're going to fabricate an alibi, why would you do it for the time that according to the state at the time, the murder didn't happen.
And also, why would you then just drop it? Why didn't you fabricate an alibi? Like, why didn't you put it on the stand? I don't understand.
Yeah, and my, you know, big takeaway and concern from this recent opinion is, I mean, as much as, of course, it hurts Adnan and it's a setback for him, is just the visibility and exposure of this case. If you imagine another disinterested witness who wasn't contacted, a potential alibi witness, etc., if they see the way that Asia was treated, despite 9 of the 11 justices and judges who heard this case finding her credible, my concern is that you're going to have some witnesses who are reluctant to step into the limelight in cases because they see the treatment that Asia got, and it was terrible and completely unnecessary in the end.
And it's the legal pretense that Asia is the only issue that matters here, but Gutierrez's ineffectiveness was so widespread that she contaminated everything. I mean, like, there were other witnesses that could have reached out to you. There could have been other Asias out there that were just never reached out to, that were never found, or not found in time, and were therefore never part of the story. But the idea that, like, Asia was the only alibi that, like, Gutierrez failed to get, that's not true.
But, let me back up. We know there's number one, not just Asia wasn't the only one she never contacted. She never contacted, like, the 70 people from the mosque she said she was going to contact.
Or the track team members.
She didn't contact track team members. She didn't contact others who, at the time, potentially saw Adnan just wandering around the school, like kids who were also hanging out at school afterwards. She contacted nobody. So, you know, and the state's argument is that, she didn't need to contact a single person because she was going to establish alibi by routine, which is not a thing because alibis are established using other methods, like either documentation, records of a person being somewhere, or people. And she did none of that. No videotapes she looked for. You know, there's a 7-Eleven across the street that had video cameras at the time. She made no effort to establish any kind of alibi for Adnan. So Asia wasn't the only thing she failed. Let's move on. Now we get to Susan Simpson. Enter Susan Simpson. I love this part, by the way. It's like, dun dun. It's awesome.
I got the case file from Rabia. She handed it over to me. I told her not to. I'm like, this is stupid. You don't know me. Because this was very early on. And she gave it to me anyway. She's like, okay, well, you know, go find stuff in there. It's always hard to hear your own voice. But after podcasting for a while, I thought I was totally over that. It turns out I'm not totally over that. Because seeing it on documentary was really hard for me. I'm like, I'm going to go hide in the other room and not watch this right now. Because it's just weird to see yourself on TV like that. I'm so used to, like, being the one doing the interviews and recording people. It's not fun always being on the other side.
I will say this, you know, when I listen to myself in the documentary and you, I feel like we're both talking so fast.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, why are we talking so fast? And I keep wondering, like, I can understand you. I'm used to you. You can understand. But I'm wondering if people who are watching, do they need, like, subtitles for us? Do they understand what's happening? Colin, what did you think about, like, how Susan came across as the interviewee? And you know, you had to explain a pretty complicated series of things in a very short time. It was just a few minutes.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, this is...
Yeah, well, that was their editing. That was it definitely took more than a few minutes for the recording part.
This is the Susan Simpson that I've known, that our listeners have known and loved for the past 4 years now is... I mean, it's her going through all the files, explaining her process, going through these maps, showing where the calls would ping the cell towers, explaining the disclaimer, everything that went wrong in this case, how this whole false narrative was constructed. And so this is essentially Susan Simpson putting a face to the voice and breaking down in great detail everything that went wrong here.
How to read subscriber activity reports. All calls are recorded in Eastern Standard Time. Good to know. And it also says, outgoing calls only are reliable for location status. Any incoming calls will not be considered reliable information for location. But what the podcast could never do, and what the documentary does so amazingly well, is the juxtaposition between what happens in terms of the evidence and what happens in terms of their interviews with the subjects. And just weaving together directly, like making it abundantly clear how the problems in the evidence reflect the problems in the testimony that happened at the trial. Whenever he forgets the script, forgets what he's supposed to be doing, they're like, no.
What happens then?
I believe... Can you bear with me for a minute? Okay, we left there. I took him back to schooling, and I went back to my friend Jen's house and waited for him to call.
One of the things I loved about... those scenes is when you, when, and they kept it in on purpose, was when you're like, wait, where's that? Where's that, Matt? Where's my, because that is, I'm like, there you go. That's Susan. That's basically me every single day. but anytime I've gone, and I've gone to your place a couple of times, it's like that many documents times 10. So.
Yeah. Like that's the thing. I brought the stuff with me. I had the documents I wanted carefully, like chosen in advance, brought with me, organized. And then within seconds, it's already a disaster.
Another great thing I was thinking about this. I'm like, you know, Susan, you're so good at getting people to talk. I mean, it explained how you reached out to Abe and initially, and I totally actually forgot for some reason. I didn't remember at all that he also had contacted Urich. And what did Urich say to him when he contacted him?
So what happened is that they made a more abbreviated version of what happened in the documentary because it's, you know, time constraints. But when I first reached out to Abe, it was to, you know, basically get an education on everything. I did not know how the AT&T system worked at all back then, like how their network was set up, like what the quirks of it were. And he's the guy to go to for that. And we did talk for a bit. And, you know, I think we got along and like he was really good at explaining things. And I had a million questions. You know, after talking for a little, emailing back and forth for a bit, I get this email from him, the one I read off in the documentary. And I didn't hear from him, I think, for a year, maybe more. Like it was a long, long time. And I never really understood why, because he's not really that kind of abrupt and, you know, that didn't seem like him. Well, eventually we started talking again. I asked him about it, and he told me it was because he'd reached out to Urich, and Urich had sent him an email that made Abe think that, like, this is going to get him in trouble if he keeps talking to me, or there's going to be bad consequences for him if he does. And that's why he cut me off.
Like, what kind of bad consequences? That's what I didn't understand. Like, what could happen to him?
They were unspecified. I've seen the email before. It was just like saying, you won't be able to handle what happens and all the attention if you keep talking. It wasn't like I'm going to do anything to you, but it was like you're not going to like the consequences if you try and talk to people about the case.
Okay, and this, yeah. Was Abe aware of Serial and all the kind of craziness around it?
He was, because he'd gotten an email from the Serial team. They basically just told him, hey, we understand all the cell records. We know what's going on. Just wanted to, you know, touch base and, like, you know, maybe run a few things by you. And he hadn't responded because I think he was kind of put off by the way they sort of assumed they already knew everything. So he never got back to them. But he knew from that about Serial. I can't remember if he listened or not when I first talked to him.
You know, I mean, I met him the first time. I wasn't in the PCR, but we were not sure if he was actually going to come out. He gave the affidavit when he realized what happened, but I think Justin convinced him to fly out in case he was going to put him on the stand. He never testified at the PCR, however, right?
Because the day, really day five, like, let's just start, like, going through as fast as we can. So he was very relieved not to have to go on the stand, but he was there and ready to do it.
And I got to meet him afterwards at the end of that day after at dinner. And I was just, I mean, you can tell he's a very, like, kind of a shy person. He doesn't want attention. But he seemed really, really shaken by all of this. I mean, he was crying because I think he realized kind of what happened after all these years. But that's, I mean, he doesn't bear any responsibility for how the state manipulated him.
And for Abe, it's not just about Anon. I mean, he obviously was deeply affected by that. But it's also for him, I think the idea of like his data being misused, like appalled him at a fundamental level, which is why he got involved.
As a matter of principle, yeah, that would piss me off too, if you're somebody who's, you know, that kind of person. Ever since I hit 40 a few years ago, I finally started taking care of my skin. Now look, it's not like I want to look 18 again. In fact, I would rather not look 18 again, but I want to look good for where I am today. I want to look rested. I want my skin to look fresh. I want to feel good about it. But here's the thing, I don't have time to go to a dermatologist. In fact, when's the last time you went to a dermatologist? It's probably been a while. And then you can turn to high-priced department store brands, gimmicky marketing tricks, but a lot of times you end up with disappointing products that don't perform and don't do anything. Well, our skin deserves more than just a trend. It deserves the real deal. And that's why ForHers.com is a new women's wellness brand cutting the cost and delivering you one of dermatologists' go-to solution for aging skin. With For Hers, you don't have any need to take travel time out of your already busy day and go visit a dermatologist, because For Hers provides access to licensed doctors online. A doctor will evaluate you, and if it's appropriate, they can prescribe you a treatment that can be delivered direct to your door. Now, one of the things I'm looking at is reducing hyperpigmentation on my skin. There might be other issues that you're dealing with, and you know, when time goes on, like, there's always different stuff that we're dealing with. You know, sometimes you get some adult onset acne. You never know what's gonna hit you. But everybody's skin is totally different, so the doctor can help tailor your treatment to you. They've got prescription high-strength retinoid face cream to help you smooth the appearance of fine lines, uneven skin texture, and a dull complexion without keeping your face stuck in one expression, and you know what I mean. And look, there's a difference between prescription skincare and over-the-counter care, because if it's not prescription, you may as well just apply the marketing directly to your face. So try it out now. Our listeners can get their first month of anti-aging formula from Hers for $10 off right now while supplies last and subject to doctor approval. Just see the website for full details. Go to forhers.com/undisclosed. That's forhers, forhers.com/undisclosed. forhers.com/undisclosed and get $10 off today. Restrictions apply. See website for full details. The documentary moves on to talk about Jay's two interviews, and they talk about, Amy asks Detective Massey, when do they decide to turn on the tape recorder? And she's referring specifically to the second interview that we know, and Susan, you say this in the documentary, that they brought him in around 3, the tape recorder comes on around 6 something, that's about 3 hours, and they refer to that as the pre-interview. So first of all, Colin, what's a pre-interview? Isn't that just another interview?
Well, let me read. This is from the opinion of the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland in a case, Cooper versus State. The defendant was Brian Cooper. This is a technique used by Detective Ritz. He was the detective in the case. It was subsequently, after Cooper's case and Adnan's case, deemed unconstitutional. So they say, the interrogation began without Miranda warnings and continued for 90 minutes. During this time, Detective Ritz told Cooper, among other things, that witnesses saw him getting out of a vehicle chasing after the victim that evening. The interrogation proceeded uninterrupted until Cooper gave a statement that placed him at the scene arguing with the victim. Then, but only then, did the detective stop Cooper from saying more. The only break in the interrogation was to set up the audio tape recording system, give Cooper the Miranda warnings, and secure a waiver from him, thereby providing him even less of an interruption than the 20-minute break given in Siebert. Interrogation then resumed, conducted by the same officer in the same environment. And much as in Siebert, Detective Ritz began the second stage of the interrogation by hearkening back to Cooper's unwarned statement, as if this part of the interrogation was merely a continuation of the first. Further, Detective Ritz candidly acknowledged he intentionally withheld the reading of the Miranda warnings during the first 90-minute stage of the interrogation for fear that Cooper would refuse to talk or ask for a lawyer. That's a pre-interview. You give the suspect what you want them to say. You get them to say it before giving Miranda. You then, after they've admitted to it, turn on the tape, give Miranda, and have them give their confession.
I like how Massey his explanation for why this was okay is that culturally in Baltimore.
So when do you decide to turn the tape recorder on, and how do you decide?
Well, the most important part of that is that people play with that a lot, meaning non-investigators, culturally in Baltimore. The first story anybody tells you is going to be a lie. Then when they refine that story, it's going to be less of a lie.
So, like, it's a cultural thing. You can't record the first interview because it's not going to be true. But then you refine it and you get more true.
I mean, the question is, you could also record the lie. I mean, like, if that's, there's no reason not to record all of it. But Colin, you're saying that that's been found to be unconstitutional.
Well, unconstitutional because of the Miranda issue.
Okay.
It's not, the not recording the pre-interview at all is not necessarily unconstitutional.
Right.
Although that's in Maryland, it is now required to record it.
Right.
But this matters too. It's not just because of Jay. So Jay, we still don't know what happened in the pre-interview because
right.
There was like 3 hours. And we have like barely 3 very, very thin pages of notes. And the story changed so radically that you know whatever happened in those 3 hours, it was an intensive workshopping of whatever Jay needed to say. But it's not just Jay that this is the problem for, because even Christy herself says, like, she's like, I wish I'd been taped from the beginning because you would have gotten a different perspective on what I was telling the cops.
So let's talk about Christy. And I'm trying to remember, because I was like, how did Christy get involved in this? Was it because of when the cops came to see Jen that Christy herself was like, oh, this must have something to do with that one night that Adnan and Jay came over, and she inserted herself? Because as far as we know, Jay doesn't bring up Christy until 2 days later, because that's the alleged first interview, whatever, February 28th.
Yeah, Jay does not mention going to Christy's place in his interview.
Oh, he doesn't in the first interview. He does in the second interview. So Christy herself, I think, maybe inserted herself into the story.
I think Jen mentions her in her interview, which is what the police say then lead on March 9th to her being interviewed.
And it's convenient because they've got cell towers pinging near her house.
Right, including the ones, as Susan notes in the documentary, that they think ping the area by her house, but in fact do not ping the area by her house.
Or somewhere else, right.
It's not just one trip to Christie's that happens. It's the two trips that Jay eventually talks about in order to explain right. The cell phone records, which just shows that like the idea that the cell phone records can corroborate anything is nonsense, because those records and Jay's story were made to match even when they didn't. Like, there's the fact that Jay's story matches anything in those records is not evidence of anything, because we know the cops intentionally led him into telling a story that fit it. In this episode, one of the biggest reveals is that during the course of the past few years, the investigators for the documentary team got in touch with Christy, and the way they got her school records is they asked her, they had to get her permission to pull her school records. They couldn't actually just like pull them without her signing off on it. But she agreed, so she signed a release, and the documentary team got the records. And when those records came back, they showed that on Wednesdays in January, including January 13th, Christy had class at her college in UMBC from 6 to 9:15, which is the exact time period that supposedly Jay and Anand were at her house.
So this basically is the winter term for the School of Social Work at UMBC for January. And these were the classes you were taking.
Right, but this wasn't the conference, right? These were just the courses winter. I took, yeah. Right?
It looks like you had a class from 6 to 9:10 every Wednesday in January.
I don't remember. I don't remember whether I just blew the class off. So I got a B. These were only three sessions? Oh, then I wouldn't have blown it off. I couldn't have. I wouldn't have passed. I wouldn't have been able to skip a winter class.
That was, when I first saw that, I sat up in my, I was like, what? I knew nothing about this. Now, I mean, Susan, you debunked the idea that was the same day that she saw them using a whole other method, because you tracked down what conferences were happening and when, and you're like, she's got her dates wrong. So this is from a couple years ago. This is something that you kind of...
Yeah, there's no conference that Kathy could have been attending. So I'm so bad at that. Sorry, Christy. There's no conference that Christy could have been attending, or that she says that she would have been attending, that happened on the 13th.
Right.
And there's so many, I think we cover, I don't even remember what episode, but in season 1 Undisclosed, we cover like all the reasons why Christie's and Jay's stories can't be about the same day. They are clearly about different days. Everything they talk about, it doesn't match in any respect other than the basic fact of going to her house. Beyond that, every single detail is different. It's not the same day.
And as Christy notes, this is something where she absolutely would have had to have been in attendance. This was a winter term class. There were only a few sessions. If she missed even one, she would fail, and she got a B. And so she herself acknowledges it couldn't have been January 13th. It couldn't have been this day that Heyman Lee disappeared.
And I think, Susan, there was a time you also, you looked at cell phone records, and there was another day that you identified. You thought this might be the day.
I mean, there's possibilities. There's possibilities. Okay. There's more than one. And it's so hard to know because, I mean, obviously, the cops never tried to pin down what day it was. And Christy and Jen are both very clear that they didn't actually know what day it is. The only reason they know what day it is because the cops told them it was that day, and they went along with it. But they had no independent recollection of when this was. I do feel pretty confident that the day that Christy and Jen recall is the same day, but it's not the same day Jay's been talking about.
You know, I continue to be shocked by the fact that we don't have the numbers for the incoming calls.
Yeah.
Right? As you said in this episode, like, he was basically convicted on the basis of the incoming calls. Is there any way, all these years later, like, we could get the incoming call information? I know, like, we've tried
No chance. There's no chance now. And it's possible that they couldn't have gotten it. Well, it's possible that they couldn't have easily gotten it back then, but that they could have gotten the hard way by pulling records of the suspected outgoing calls. So, like, say, go to whoever's house that I think was calling and check to see if they were. And that was never done.
So you mean it's not like a kind of automatically general, like now I can go onto my T-Mobile website and just look at everything.
Yeah, it was different back then, and we don't know exactly what we just don't know. No one actually looked into to see what the database was. I mean, honestly, if they'd talked to Abe, he probably could have told them. If they'd asked him to like help them explore what data was available, he probably could have helped with that, but no one ever tried. And I think this is like one area where I think it's worth pointing out that I feel like where Serial's storytelling sort of failed. Anon has never said that the trip to Christie's happened on January 13th. He has never said that. He has never had a distinct memory of that happening on the 13th. And the way they presented in Serial is as if like, oh, everyone all agrees that this all happened on the 13th. Well, no, it's not really the case. Anon didn't necessarily dispute that it happened on the 13th, but he never recalled going to Christie's that day until trial. When she's saying, and Jen's saying, and Jay's saying that he did, and he's like, okay. But he never personally had the recollection. He does recall going to her house.
Yeah, the one thing he's always said is that he knew he had been there once, and he was very high when he went. He just, because everybody's telling him, kind of like with Asia, she's telling the wrong date, and he just is accepting what's being told to him. And I would understand that in that position. If you've got three people saying it was that day, he's probably like, okay, I know I went there once. I don't know what day it was.
Just like Christy and Jen accept that it was the 13th because they were told it was the 13th. Anon, in turn, accepts their word as a 13th. I mean, all of them are just accepting as they're told by someone else.
And Anon in the attorney notes says, I remember getting the Officer Adcock call when I was in my car, which of course is fundamentally different from Christy, who says that he got the call at her place.
Yeah, Anon does has a very distinct memory of that call. I mean, the idea that Anon doesn't remember any of that day isn't true because he does have some memories. Yeah. It's just he's never been able, like the memories he has are conflicting with the stories he's been told. So he could not be sure whether his memory was correct or if what others were telling him was correct. But his memory is that the phone rang when it was still in the glove box. And that when he like, you know, fumbled in the glove box while high, he gets the phone and answers it. And suddenly it's a police officer talking to him. And he remembers Jay being in the car with him at the time. So his memory there is pretty distinct and firm. It's just he's always had to question that now because everyone's telling him that didn't happen that way.
Yeah, but even in the face of people saying that, he's always maintained that, no, he was in the car when he got that call.
Right. But the Kathy part.
Right. The Kathy part. I mean, like, that couldn't have been the police call because that's not how he would respond to a police officer. He wouldn't say to a police officer, what am I supposed to say if they call me? I mean, like, none of that makes sense. So
also, there were three calls in that time period, not the one that Christy remembers. There's nothing about Christy's testimony that sounds like it's the 13th. There's nothing about it that would make you think it's the 13th. Literally, except for her saying it's the 13th, there's no reason to think it is on that day. And that's because it wasn't.
Right. So her face, wow, as it dawned on her. To me, Christy comes across as, like, she really kind of believed what she was being told. And you could see even now, I mean, Jen is all over the place. I can't read Jen. I cannot tell when she's being, I still think she's mostly bullshitting. I don't know what she's making up, what she's not. But with Christy, I think she was pretty sincere the entire time. And she's just shocked.
This is just reading into people's reactions, which is not reliable. But my impression, just watching that, is that she has carried a doubt with her. Like, in the back of her head, she's always been like, I don't actually know it's the 13th. So I think that's part of why she was motivated to agree to sign off on the release of the records. Like, she was like, she thought it was the 13th. She's always said that story, but there was something in her that doubted. And when she saw those school records, you could just see that moment. She's like, oh my God, I got it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, so here's my thing. You know, this is what I tweeted about, where I said, it's now extremely difficult for anyone still to believe that Anon is guilty. And that's because I'm in the exact same boat as Susan. We have interlocking testimony by Jen and Christy about a day when Jay and Anon went to Christy's place. There was a phone call that Jen made and talked to Christy, her boyfriend Jeff, and Anon. They made arrangements for Anon to drop off Jay and him to be picked up, and then Jay and Jen go to Christie's place. As this makes clear, that is not January 13th. And why is that significant? Let's go back and look at the state's case at trial. One, state says that Jay calls Jen at 4:12 p.m. asking if Christie is home. Two, Jay then drops Anon off at track practice and goes to Christie's place. Three, he's at Christie's place when he gets the call from Anon to pick him up from track practice. Four, Jay then picks up Anon. They go directly back to Christie's place. Five, again, both witnesses say this, Jen and Christy. Jen calls over to Christie's place, talks to Jay, Christy, and Christy's boyfriend, Jeff. Next, Jeff tells Jen that she's supposed to pick up Jay at Gilston Park. Adnan is then at Christie's place when he gets the Adcock call. That call causes him to freak out and leave with Jay to bury Hay's body in Lincoln Park. Jay then sends a confusing page to Jen about not picking him up at Gilston Park. That's what leads to Jen calling Adnan's phone. The Lincoln Park pings. Someone answers the phone, tells Jen that Jay will call her back after he's done. Jay thereafter calls Jen, pick up at Westview Mall. Jen picks up Jay. They dispose of the shovels in the dumpster. They later return to Christie's place. What this now tells us is this entire visit is on a different day. That means, A, Christie is completely irrelevant to January 13th, and we have to wonder, how is it planted in her head by the police or someone else that this took place on the 13th? Jen, again, is probably remembering the same day as Christie, which means...
Yeah, it makes Jen irrelevant, too. It's not Christie's irrelevant, it's
Jen
also
is
Jen.
Jen is gone as corroboration. That day that she's claiming the shovels and Jay telling her about the murder, that's not this day. That's some other day. And so then she's just completely gone as corroboration. And then you have Jay. I mean, his entire story starting at 4:12 p.m. is clearly a construction of the police based upon the cell tower pings. And none of that stuff happened on January 13th. And that just leaves you with nothing. There's no evidence. The pings are irrelevant. Jen is irrelevant. Christie's irrelevant. Jay's entire story is nonsense from another day. There's just nothing left.
To keep Jay's story, you have to go back to his first statement, the one that does not involve Jen and Art Christie.
Let me ask you this. What if Jen says now that, you know what, maybe none of that stuff happened on the 13th, but I know when I picked him up on that day, he did see Jen that day. That's what we know. I know when I saw him that day. He told me about the murder the same day.
It means Jay told her about it on a different day.
I would also say we are not at all certain that Jen saw Jay on that day. There's a credible theory that he went over and hung out with Mark Pusateri, and Jen was never home that afternoon. That's kind of corroborated by the March 18th ride-along notes.
I want to know why nobody has talked to Mark Pusateri. Where the hell is Mark? Not at the trial, not now, not with Serial.
Well, here's another thing. We do know the police talked to someone else. So they talked to Christie on March 9th. She gives her story. On March 11th, they talked to her boyfriend, Jeff, and there are notes saying, after we talked to Jeff, we talked to Christie again. There are no notes from the Jeff interview. There are no notes from the second Christie interview. I have a strong suspicion Jeff said something that made them think possibly this was not January 13th, and that's why we have no notes from those two sets of interviews.
Wait, you mean he didn't tell the police, oh snap?
Right.
The reason this guy Jeff matters is that Jay says that when he went over to Christie's that night with Anon, he tells Jeff, Christie's boyfriend, while they're there, oh yeah, that dude killed his girlfriend. And Jeff apparently says, really? Oh snap.
And if this did happen, if they talked to Jeff and Jeff is corroborating what everyone else is saying about this visit on the 13th and then what Susan just commented on, he should absolutely be a witness for the prosecution. He'd be great. He would corroborate this whole visit, and that would be huge for the prosecution. The fact that we don't have him testifying, it's a huge question mark there.
Yeah. All right, guys, I have to pop off now. There are some other stuff I want to talk about, including how hard it is to get a box hunting passport, but maybe in the addendum. So I'll let you guys continue, and our listeners, I'll be back in a week.
This is not just about the trip to Christie's house. It's also about the trip to Lincoln Park, because the way they try and prove at trial, the way the state tries and prove at trial that, you know, Adnan has his cell phone in the park at first half of 7 o'clock hour is that Jen supposedly calls and is trying to get Jay. But the reason she's calling is because of their plans to go over to Christie's that night. This is related to the Christie trip as well. Jen is calling to find out when she can get Jay so they can go back to Christie's. So all of that is tied to whatever day Christie and Jen are thinking of. And none of it ties back to the 13th.
Yeah, and Christie has a clear recollection in her testimony that it was the exact same night that Jay and Adnan came over that then later Jen and Jay came over. And right, so this completely knocks out the Lincoln Park pings. They don't make sense. And again, that's what's been called the crux of the state's case against Adnan. No longer holds any water.
In short, the whole story at Adnan's trial was never about January 13th, the day of the murder. It was all about the day, whatever day it was, that Jay first decides to tell his friend Jen and Christie about Jay and Hay and whatever Adnan is telling them about at that time. But it's not on the 13th. He's telling them about it on a different date. Why he's telling them about it, we don't know. When exactly it is, we're not sure. But it's very clear to me, especially from Jen's second interview, this is going on later in time, closer to the time of the arrest than to the time of the murder. Because the way Jen describes the intervening period, it's not like a month and a half till the body's found. It's a matter of weeks.
Yeah, and so then the episode turns to Heyman Lee's community and the Korean-American community there in Baltimore and gives some interesting contour and detail to the fact that, you know, these Korean-Americans at the time were trying to integrate into society and had sort of jobs such as being shop owners. And there had been some exonerations in the 90s in these killings of Korean-Americans. And that led to the community sort of mobilizing. And this interesting scene at the bail hearing where half the courtroom is the Pakistani-American community on Anand's side and the other half is the Korean-American community on the Heyman Lee side. And so, Susan, what did you think about that?
It was a sign of many failures in Baltimore and how they've affected different communities in different ways. And I forget who it was, but one of the members of the Korean community comments that, yes, they make arrests and then nothing ever happens, which kind of goes back to an issue at the time and how Baltimore police were clearing cases to get their stats up. And clearing a case just meant making an arrest. It didn't mean making an arrest that you could actually prosecute successfully. So yes, people would commit horrible crimes and get arrested, but then nothing would ever happen to them because either it couldn't be prosecuted or the prosecutors would try and the case would fall apart and there'd be an acquittal.
Right. And then in terms of the substance of the bail hearing, we have, you know, the question of, is it a mistake or not? Is it the police trying to pressure Adnan into pleading guilty? But despite the fact that he's a minor, this is listed as a capital offense. Capital offenses are non-bailable, so he's denied bail at the first hearing. And then we can see the video and audio of the second bail hearing where the arguments are made about Adnan having this relative in Pakistan who can make people disappear.
Your Honor, the fact that the defendant has strong support from the community, that is what makes him unique in this case. He has the resources of this entire community here. Our investigation reveals that the defendant has an uncle in Pakistan, and he has indicated that he can make people disappear.
God, it made me so angry. It was just, I knew the whole story. I've read it all before. It wasn't like new to me, and it was still like just emotionally impactful. Just to see the lines being said that I've read before, but can't remember having watched, of, you know, there's this pattern of Pakistani males being jilted and fleeing and able to, you know, successfully evade prosecution. Just this, painting this picture of like these Muslim men who get spurned by an American lover and kill her and then skip off back home and can never be touched again.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't know. Even without these arguments, Adnan certainly could have been denied bail. That said, he had a clean record. He had community support. His family was willing to put up his house. There were other members of the mosque community willing to put up their houses as collateral. And that's a huge part of this case because, as we've discussed earlier, trial counsel was making so many errors. Even in a normal case, the statistics show if you're detained pending trial, your chances of being convicted go way up. But in this case, with trial counsel having such failures, with Adnan being in jail as opposed to being out there and maybe able to help in the investigation some more, this really put him behind the eight ball.
Yeah. And if he was out on bail, he couldn't, like, you know, go around talking to people about the case. That wouldn't be allowed. But he'd have more contact with his family, more contact with his attorneys. He wouldn't be at the mercy of Gutierrez and like, hey, did you check on this? Like, he can make sure like regularly, like, hey, by the way, here's like things I know. Can you? And also he has people coming to him in person. If he goes back to school, maybe people come up to him and say, hey, look, do you remember this day? And he can say, hey, please call my attorney or call my family or call someone.
Yeah, and then we sort of flip it to the other side and we see that there were also complications in the way that Jay was handled over the summer. And, you know, the episode very much, as we discussed, focuses upon Jay's first police statement on February 28th, his then second very different statement on the 15th. He also had that ride along I mentioned before on March 18th where his story changes again.
Also very different, yeah.
And then on April 13th, when the officers are testifying before the grand jury, we have no notes from his statement, but the report says basically they were getting the story straight before they went before the grand jury. And as this episode notes, Jay was sort of a sitting duck during this whole time because he hadn't been charged with a crime and therefore hadn't had triggered the right to counsel. That eventually comes in September when eventually he is arrested. Kevin Yurick procures an attorney, Ann Benaroya, for him, and we see the plea hearing in the episode. And what were your thoughts on the plea hearing, Susan?
Well, to back up the timeline, keep in mind here in the second interview from Jay in March, the first one in March, he confesses to murder. The facts he tells the police, they aren't just accessory to the fact. He actually confesses to murder. He is accessory before the murder, which is not a thing. That's just accessory to murder. From March until September, he's walking around free in the community. No one's told that he's actually confessed to a murder. If Anand's a risk, so is he. But, you know, Anand's sitting in jail and Jay's walking around not even charged. And Jay can't really do anything about it. He just has to live his life for months on end, having secretly confess to a murder, and then waits until September when finally they decide to go forward with a judge that's too good to be true, as they say in the documentary.
Yeah, and that was interesting. I hadn't known that before, which is that so Ivan Bates, who was formerly a prosecutor as well as a defense attorney and still is, but ran for state's attorney in Baltimore last year, he was in the courtroom for the bail hearing, and he has the commentary. This judge, Judge McCurdy, whom they had the plea hearing for Jay before, basically says this is a guy who was known to be lenient in sentencing young individuals like Jay. And as you say, Susan, it's almost too good to be true. This initial hearing and then the later hearing after trial where Yurick is saying, you know, Jay is unlike other defendants I see. He seemed truly upset and shaken and wanting to atone, and is basically greasing the wheels on McCurdy not giving him a prison term.
And not just that. We cover this in more detail in season one of Undisclosed, but it's really important to remember. Jay is not actually sentenced in that first hearing. It's not even a sentencing hearing. It's like a pre-hearing. And what Baltimore did, what Yurick did, was to set up a plea where Jay is locked in. He is locked in as going to be pleading guilty, has basically almost pled guilty. He can't back out now, but he's not sentenced. And the jury can be told that he faces that 5 years in prison. But what's known all along is Jay is not going to spend 5 years in prison. But and because that's not actually put on the record until after Anand's trial, the jury never hears it.
And then, Susan, the final part of the episode is sort of bittersweet. And, you know, obviously this was filmed and put together before we had the recent ruling of the Court of Appeals, but we're introduced to Justin Brown, Anand's PCR attorney.
Yeah, I felt sick watching that.
I have told my client that as long as he wants me to represent him, I will fight till the bitter end. If we lose this, I will appeal. If we lose the appeal, we'll go to federal court. I might be 80 years old still litigating this case, but if that's what it takes, I will not give up on Adnan Syed.
Yeah, and it was tough to watch because, you know, he's done a terrific job in this case, got the two lower courts to rule in favor of Adnan and loses this 4-3 verdict, but the end of the episode is, you know, on the one hand, him saying, I'm going to continue fighting for Adnan and I'm not going to give this fight up. But it's also him coming home to his family and
all the things Adnan never got a chance to have.
Yeah, which we juxtapose against Adnan's mother and his father and brother and talking about they hope that they get this moment where he comes home again. And, you know, again, at the time this episode is put together, it's very much hopeful and thinking there's a good chance this is affirmed, but as it turns out now, in between this episode and today, we do have the court overturning this verdict and the new trial disappearing.
And that's what kills me about the court's verdict. I mean, so much of it kills me. But the way they latch on to everything about Anand's story about the 13th and use it as proof that he's probably a murderer. Well, if he's a murderer, well then, you know what? Christy Vincent's a murderer, and Jim Pusateri's a murderer, and Jay's definitely a murderer. And basically everyone in that freaking school is a murderer because none of them know what they're doing on the 13th, and all of them have been falsely told and remember things that didn't happen the way they did. Like, Anand is so not different in any respect from anyone else's memory of that day. The only difference for him is that he's the one being charged with it. So where he has, like, stumbles and where he's confused by what people are telling him about what happened that day when it conflicts with his own memories, that's evidence that he's a liar and that he's, like, faking an alibi or faking a defense. Whereas for everyone else, it's like, oh, that's understandable and normal, but it doesn't change the fact that they must definitely be talking about the 13th.
Yeah, and for me, this is the end of the sort of forgetful Adnan meme where, you know, people wonder, well, how is he forgetful? How does he forget the events of the day and have sort of a patchwork spotty memory? Well, I mean, he's doing the right thing, which is he would have that memory, which is not complete and which is mistaken. We see that today. We see with Jen, Christy, and Jay, their entire story of all these events that they think occur on January 13th, they're wrong. And as Christy herself says, I wish you heard me initially because I was much less certain. That's Adnan. He thinks maybe some things happened that day. He's not sure. And as this episode reveals, you can be pretty convinced that something happened on a certain day and just be completely wrong.
Yeah. And that's why we have Jen and Christy here, who to this day maintain the story. Christy maintains the story. Jen more or less does, actually. She does basically still tell that story. And it's because this whole time they have had a real memory they're falling back on. And they've been using a real memory to tell their story. That part is true to some extent, and that's what they always fall back on. But now, I mean, we saw how Krista reacted, and then we saw how Jen reacted to the news.
For real, I'm ready to change my name to get out of this shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't want any fucking thing to do with it. Period. Flat. Out. I wish I never would have talked to y'all in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, my impression of Christy was sort of similar to yours. She seems like a conscientious person. She seems like she wanted to do the right thing. And that's why she's frankly so shaken when she realizes that this couldn't have been the 13th. She admits, I think that Adnan is guilty, and yet you're giving me information that means I'm thinking about a different day. And that means this entire sequence of events put together by the state, that's taking calls on a certain day and events in a certain day and trying to juxtapose them to what they claim happened on the 13th.
Yeah, but for Jen, though, when her reaction is anger.
Yeah, she certainly seems like she's done with Jay's bullshit. And I don't know.
Oh, really? So I didn't take, well, I kind of got that. I got an impression she was done with the documentary's bullshit.
Oh,
She was upset about the hearing. She just was in denial.
Both. I think she's just done with everything. I think if there were a third trial, she would do everything to get out of testifying. She's done with Jay. She's done with the documentarians. She's done with everything. She's just over it all.
Well, Jen, I have good news for you. There's no one who wants you as a witness. So you are probably fine. And then we go back to the last person involved in the story, which is Jay. And why did he bring Jen and Christy into it? Well, because the cops needed him to explain certain cell phone pings. And that's all it was.
And now Jay's story, which, I mean, that's part of the big basis for the Court of Appeals affirming Adnan's conviction, is they mention all the points at which Jay is corroborated. They have to do that. It's a time capsule review based upon what happened at trial. Now what we've found out with this episode, among other evidence, is he's not corroborated at all. In fact, everything he says is completely dispelled and doesn't make sense anymore.
And doesn't matter, because Gutierrez never tried to investigate the day this all happened on, even after she had the mistrial, which should have given her enough time to reevaluate the state. Because, so back up a bit. A lot of the stuff that happened at trial was not disclosed to the defense in advance. The prosecution did not have to give it over, or sometimes did have to and didn't. But the thing about Christy, that was tipped off in that first trial, and Gutierrez never tried to find out what the class schedule was for her. Never tried to check her agenda, check her records of when she was. Like, the whole trial would have been different if she just made an effort to make sure Christy had the right day.
True. And as you note, she was forestalled in some ways by the state not disclosing certain things, like the fact that they interviewed Jeff as well and then re-interviewed Christy. But even without that, she certainly sort of reached out between trials and tried to figure out whether this story actually matched up with reality.
Thanks so much for tuning in this week, guys. Don't forget to check out this week's addendum as well. And last week's, if you didn't hear it, John Cryer is back with us for this season. And we'll be back in one more week.